power. Now that's a man's word. Whether you're talking trucks or tools, cars or computers, guns or gadgets, it's all about the power. Horsepower, firepower, manpower. That's what men like to talk about. The biggest, the baddest, the best. It's all about the power. Can't you hear echoes of Tim the Toolman Taylor on the old show Home Improvement? Arr. Yeah, some of our young people don't even know what I'm talking about there. Well, this quest for power has infiltrated the church as well. Today, power is in. There's power evangelism, power prayer, power preaching, power healing, power encounters, and power ministry of every shape and size. There's even power ties that power preachers wear on power Sundays. I've got to get me one of those. Now, power can be understood in one of two ways. As the ability to do something, or the authority to do something. The first speaks of strength and muscle, while the second refers to the right or the position to do something. Athletes may strive for the first kind of power, while the second is sought after in politics, business, and, sad to say, in some churches. Now, you need not have one to have the other. I know that the popular saying says, might makes right, but I have seen huge, muscle-bound men be brought down to size by a little old woman just because they call her mom. She may not have the physical strength to subdue them, but she does have the authority. And it's this second kind of power, the power of authority, that forms the focus of our message today. In John 19, verse 10, we read of another question by Pilate. It's actually two questions. And these questions reverberate down to our own day and age. He said to Jesus, "Do you refuse to speak to me? Don't you realize I have power either to free you or to crucify you?" In some ways, Pontius Pilate was the portrait of power in his own day. He had the political power of being appointed by the emperor to his present post. And with this came certain advantages. High officials in the Roman Empire and some members of the Senate were privileged to join the elite fraternity called the Amici Caesaris, which means friends of Caesar. You would get a ring with the emperor's image stamped on it. And it was a very exclusive club. When you were in Rome, you could go to certain events, certain parties, certain gatherings that only the friends of Caesar could attend. As governor of Judea, Pilate commanded the Roman contingent of soldiers, giving him military power to enforce the law and to protect himself, if necessary. His position also gave him judicial power to hear cases, pronounce verdicts, and sentence the guilty to appropriate punishments that were carried out immediately. Pilate's decisions could only be appealed to the emperor himself, and that only by a Roman citizen. So when Pilate says to Jesus, "Don't you realize I have power either to free you or to crucify you?" He's practically bragging to Jesus that he held the power of life and death in his own hands. Now you might ask, what led Pilate to ask this question? And I think you need to see the context. And this is why we had the entire passage read earlier in our service. If you go back a few verses, you find that Pilate had said to the Jewish leaders, "I find no fault in him," meaning I don't find him guilty of any crime. He did have him flogged. He thought that maybe he could elicit some sympathy from these Jewish leaders. But it didn't work. The Jewish leaders said, "Hey, we have a law that this man should die because he claimed to be the Son of God." Now at this, Pilate was a little spooked. He was afraid. You know, the Romans, they believed in all kinds of gods, but they were very superstitious. And they didn't like to cross other people's gods. And the text tells us that he was afraid. He was afraid, and so he brings Jesus back and he says, "Where do you come from?" But Jesus wouldn't answer him. Jesus wouldn't say anything. And I hear in Pilate's words a bit of anger at Jesus' refusal to answer him. And probably this anger is rooted in arrogance and pride. "You won't speak to me? Don't you know who I am?" You ever heard people say that? "Don't you know who I am? I'm important. You should listen to me. You should speak to me. When I ask you a question, you better answer me." You get that sense in Pilate's words here. Maybe he was using this as a threat, a way to intimidate Jesus to give an answer. He's using the threat of power, which is what intimidation is all about. But I think Warren Wiersbe discerns the real crux of the matter when he writes, "Fear and anger often go together. When we are afraid we are weak, we go to the other extreme and try to appear strong." And this is what Pilate did as he reminded Jesus of his Roman authority. But his statement did not demonstrate his power. It demonstrated his weakness. For if he had the authority to release Jesus, why did he not do it? He condemned himself with his own boastful words. Isn't that true? On one hand, Pilate boasts of the power that he has, and he uses a Greek term that literally means authority. And yet on the other hand, he tries every possible maneuver to avoid using that power. I mean, he tries change of venue. He tries quashing the case for lack of evidence. He would wash his hands and say, "I'm innocent of this." He tried the trade-off, as we're going to see next week, with Barabbas. He tries all of these possible maneuvers so as not to use his power, the very power he's bragging to Jesus that he has. As John Phillips notes, it was an empty claim at best. He had already attested to the prisoner's innocence 3 times, and yet he still hadn't released him. He himself was a prisoner, a captive of his own fear of the Jews and their ability to make trouble for him with Rome. And Jesus could see right through this. And his reply in verse 11 demonstrates the delusion of human autonomy. So what does that mean? Autonomy is the idea that I am my own man. I make my own way. Like the old Frank Sinatra song, "I did it my way." That's autonomy. I'm independent. I can pull myself up by my own bootstraps. You ever tried that? It doesn't work very well, does it? And Jesus says to Pilate in verse 11, "You would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above." Now, Pilate says, "I have the power." Jesus says, "You would have no power except that it was given to you." Oh, how mankind lives under this delusion today. We think we have it all together, that everything's under control, that we can live however we please. Now, it's true. God has given us a great deal of latitude to make choices in our lives. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. But that does not mean that we have the power to do whatever we want. Jesus spoke of a successful farmer in Luke 12, verses 16 through 20. "The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. He thought to himself, 'What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops.' Then he said, 'This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. You thought Dairy Queen came up with that line for a commercial. That's actually out of the Bible. But God said to him, you fool. This very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? He thought he had it all together. He thought he had it all mapped out. I've got it all under control. And God says, you have no clue. You have nothing that hasn't been given to you. And what has been given to you can be taken away. James warns us in James 4, 13 through 16. Now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business and make money. Why, you don't even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You're a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast and brag, and all such boasting is evil. See, when we leave God out of the picture, when we think we have it all under control, we are living under a delusion. The delusion of human autonomy. Like the classic poem, Invictus, that reads, I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. Oh, that sounds so inspiring. There's only one problem. It just ain't so. A very prominent Christian businessman wrote an article with a strange title. He called it The Art of Being a Big Shot. And among the very insightful things that he said were these words. It is my pride that makes me independent of God. It is appealing to me to feel that I am the master of my fate, that I run my own life, call my own shots, go it alone. But that feeling is my basic dishonesty. I can't go it alone. I have to get help from other people, and I can't ultimately rely on myself. I'm dependent on God for my next breath. It is dishonest of me to pretend that I am anything but a man, small, weak, and limited. So living independent of God is a self-delusion. It is not just a matter of pride being an unfortunate little trait and humility being an attractive little virtue. It's my inner psychological integrity that's at stake. When I am conceited, I am lying to myself about what I am. I am pretending to be God and not man. My pride is the idolatrous worship of myself. And that is the national religion of hell. Now, I realize that the above statement might be considered un-American. But I would suggest that the American concept of rugged individualism, I can do it myself, and I'm free, I can do whatever I please. I think that's in reality unscriptural. We are not in control nearly as much as we think we are. Now, in response to Pilate's arrogant delusion, Jesus points to the delegation of human authority. Verse 11 we read, Jesus answered, "You would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above." Pilate's boasting about his power, his authority, but Jesus reminded him that his so-called authority was only delegated to him from God. And one day God would call him to account for the way he used his privileges and his responsibilities. Now the Bible clearly teaches that God is sovereign. And that word means that God is ultimately in control. He has delegated power to human beings. Daniel 4, verse 17 proclaims, "The Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men." So He is actually above them all. Furthermore, Paul writes in Romans 13:1, "Everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established." The authorities that exist have been established by God. Now, when Paul says that the authorities that exist have been established by God, he is not suggesting that God is responsible for the election of every government official. Nor is he responsible for what every government official does. The phrase means that God has established the principle of governmental authority, so that the official is actually the servant of God. If you keep reading in Romans 13, he uses that phrase in two different occasions. And as such, he deserves respect and obedience. We may not respect the person, but we should respect the office. Now, within this regard, Charles Stanley makes an insightful observation. He writes, "No one exercises any authority at all in this world unless God first gives it to him or her. As children of a sovereign God, we are never victims of our circumstances." Did you catch that? We are never victims of our circumstances. Why? Because God is in control. God is sovereign. And he can even work through the worst decisions to bring about what is best. Whenever things look bad, we can still take comfort in the fact that God is ultimately in control. Now, this delegation of human authority, it goes all the way back to the very beginning. When God created Adam and Eve and placed them in the Garden of Eden, he said in Genesis 1:28, "Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth." But notice what he says, "And subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground." God here delegates the authority over his creation to these human beings that he has formed. Now, I ask you this question. Does this make God any less sovereign? Has he given up his sovereignty by delegating authority to humans? And the answer is no. He has not given full reign. He has not given up all of his authority to mankind. Man is still limited. Man cannot do whatever he pleases. God is still ultimately in control. He has established certain boundaries over which man can exercise his delegated authority. I can't do anything I want. It doesn't matter how free or how powerful I think I am. I can get up on top of this roof, which would be a trick in itself. And if I say I think I can fly and jump off, you know, gravity's going to take over. I'm going to hit the ground. We are not absolutely free to do whatever we want. God has not given all of his authority away. And he still retains his sovereignty. Now, I'd like for a moment to broaden the scope of this principle beyond the delegated authority to human government. Because quite honestly, most of us will never be there. Most of us will never hold an elected position in government, whether it be local, state, on the federal level. So you might say, well, this doesn't have anything to do with me. Actually, it does. I believe that God has delegated to every person some authority when it comes to his or her own destiny. And this is sometimes called free will. When God placed Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, he gave them a choice: to obey or to disobey God. And we know that they chose to disobey. But that did not change this authority God has delegated to every person to choose the direction of their destiny. Notice how many times in the Bible people are challenged to choose. In Deuteronomy 30, verse 19, Moses tells the people of Israel, This day I call heaven and earth as witnesses against you, that I have set before you life and death, blessings and cursings. Now choose life so that you and your children may live. It wasn't going to just happen to them. It wasn't predetermined beforehand so that they're victims of fate or victims of somebody else's choice. Each person is to choose. This is also echoed in Joshua chapter 24. Joshua has led the people of Israel into the promised land. He has realized that his time on earth is about over. And so he gathers the people and he gives them this challenge. Now fear the Lord. Serve Him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your forefathers worshipped beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve. Whether the gods your forefathers served beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are now living. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Did you get that? Choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve. Make up your mind. Determine the direction of your destiny. That is a choice that God has given every human being. Now, did He have to do that? No. He could have created us without that authority, without that ability to choose, but He didn't. And I would still say that He has not forfeited His sovereignty in giving mankind the power to choose. I have this running battle with people. There's a particular fellow that I'm friends with from Bible college days, and he just pounds on this idea that man does not have free will. Free will is a myth. And his whole purpose, I believe, is to defend God's sovereignty. You don't have to defend God's sovereignty. God is sovereign. But in His sovereignty, He has given mankind, He has delegated to mankind the authority to make choices. I believe this is what separates humans from the animal kingdom. Animals act on instinct. We have the ability to choose. And sometimes we make choices that defy logic. They make no sense whatsoever. But that's a freedom, that's an authority, that is a power God has given to us. Now, does this mean we have absolute freedom to do whatever I want? No, that's absurd. But God has delegated to man some authority. And part of that authority, part of that power, is the ability to make choices. And He challenges us to choose. He does not force us to choose Him or to not choose Him. This is a power, this is an ability, an authority that He has delegated to us. Now this brings us to our final thought. The determination of human accountability. Let's go back to John 19. At the end of verse 11, after Jesus had told Pilate, "You would have no power over me except that it was given to you from above," He adds this line, "Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin." Jesus here is speaking of the responsibility borne by those who were involved in His trial and in His death. Now let's first consider who is the one who handed me over to you. Some think it would be Judas who betrayed Jesus. But that really doesn't fit because Judas didn't hand Jesus to Pilate. He handed Him over to the Jews. Now I'm not trying to excuse Judas here. I just don't think that's who Jesus means. Some think it means the whole Jewish hierarchy, and certainly they do share in the responsibility. Now let me make one thing clear. This does not mean that all Jews are responsible for Jesus' death. That wasn't even true in His own day. It was a small minority of Jews who orchestrated all this. Why do you think they arrested him at night? Why do you think they broke 18 of their own laws to condemn Jesus? Because most of the people would have been against them. Most of the Jewish people were favorable of Jesus. Paul Meyer suggests that if there had been a vote taken in Jerusalem during Passion Week, pro Jesus or against Jesus, Jesus would have probably carried at least 70%. I think it would have even been higher than that. So don't think that all Jews are somehow responsible for Jesus' death. Now, theologically, you can say that we're all responsible for His death. That's true because our sins put Him on the cross. But when it comes to the actual condemning and having Jesus crucified, there's been many, many years of misinterpretation, misunderstanding, that all Jews, both then and since, are responsible for Jesus' blood. That is not true. And that's not what he's talking about here either, because he says, the one who handed me over to you. And who's he speaking of there? Caiaphas, the high priest. He is the one taking the lead. He was the one during those illegal trials the night before, who was leading the interrogation, who was leading the prosecution. He is the one who guided the Sanhedrin into the decision they made into what they were doing that morning before Pilate. So Jesus here is speaking of Caiaphas, the high priest. Now, why would Caiaphas be guilty of a greater sin? Well, he was the high priest. He had at his disposal all of the Scriptures. In Romans, Paul talks about the advantages of being a Jew. And he says there are many. God revealed Himself to the Jews first. They have His Word. They have His revelation. They know the truth. And Caiaphas should have known better. Caiaphas had all of the information available to him. Pilate did not. Jesus recognized that. And the same is true today. There are many people, particularly in our culture, who have had every opportunity to hear the truth. We are almost saturated with God's Word in our culture. Not, maybe not as much now as another generation ago, but still, the opportunities are there. There are churches everywhere. There are whole television stations that are dedicated to the proclaiming of the truth. Now, some of them that claim to aren't really doing a very good job of it, but there's Christian radio. Bibles are plentiful. And we will be held more accountable for what we have been exposed to. This does not mean, though, that Pilate was excused from all responsibility. After all, if there's a greater sin, that implies that there's a lesser sin, and that was Pilate's. He didn't bear all the authority that he thought he did, but he was a man that God had delegated authority, and he will be held responsible. He will be held accountable for his actions in this case. You see, authority always leads to accountability. Jesus taught this in Luke 12, verses 47 and 48. That servant who knows his master's will and does not get ready, and does not do what his master wants, he will be beaten with many blows. But the one who does not know and does things deserving punishment will be beaten with few blows. From everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded. And from the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked. If the only authority we are given is over our own selves, we will still be accountable to God for the choices we make. And the more we know about God's will, His desires, the more accountable we are for our actions. Pilate should have known better than to make the decisions he made just based on basic principles of justice. He didn't even have to know the Jewish scriptures to know that this was a travesty here. He knew that Jesus wasn't guilty of any of the crimes they charged him with. And over he says, "I find no basis for your charges. This man is not guilty of any crimes." He tries to wash his hands of the whole affair. Doesn't work. But it just proves that he knew. He wasn't fooled. He wasn't duped. He couldn't go back later and say, "Well, they tricked me." No, they didn't. He knew. Now, Caiaphas, the high priest, and the whole hierarchy there of the Jewish leadership, they should have known more. They knew who Jesus was. They knew what Jesus claimed to be, and they knew the scriptures that backed it up. And they still made the choices that they made. Yes, they were responsible for a greater sin because they sinned against the light. They sinned against the truth. Pilate was still in the dark. He was still a pagan. He didn't know the prophecies of the Messiah to come. But it didn't make him any less liable for the decisions he did make. And every person will be held accountable. We cannot avoid the responsibility that we all have because God has given us the authority, given us the power to make choices. But with that authority comes accountability. The Bible tells us that we will all give an account of ourselves before God. Nothing in all creation is hidden from God's sight. Everything is uncovered and laid bare before the eyes of Him to whom we must give an account. One day every man, every woman, every child who ever lived will appear before God and be accountable to Him. Donald Carson writes, "Even the worst evil cannot escape the outer boundaries of God's sovereignty. Yet God's sovereignty never mitigates the responsibility and guilt of moral agents who operate under divine sovereignty, while their voluntary decisions and their evil rebellion never render God utterly dependent." So what does that mean? That means God maintains His sovereignty even as He gives man limited authority. And God is not bound by the choices people make. God does not sit in heaven and say, "Oh, Gabriel, look, what am I going to do now?" It doesn't happen that way. God still exercises His control, and He can use even the worst decisions to bring about His will. But that makes mankind no less accountable to Him. You know, Pilate thought he had it all under control. He thought he had the power. The power over Judea, the power over Jesus, the power over his own little world. Jesus informed him that he was living under the delusion of human autonomy. God had delegated that human authority to him. And God delegates human authority even down to the lowest person in society. They still can make choices. They can still determine the direction of their destiny. But with that authority comes accountability. Man is not the master of his fate. God is. Man is not the captain of his own soul, answerable only to himself. Oh no. One day we will all stand before God's judgment seat. I like the way Everett Harrison summed up this text. He says, "Pilate the judge was himself on trial all the time he was supposedly trying Jesus." Isn't that the case? Isn't that the case? Here Pilate thought he was the judge and he had the power. He could decide life and death and make all these determinations. But really it's Pilate that's on trial. And what's the verdict of Pilate in this case? Certainly he is guilty. He is guilty of gross injustice, condemning a man to death that he knew was innocent. He was also guilty of rejecting the truth, rejecting the life, rejecting the way. And one day Pilate will stand before Jesus to give an account of his actions, not just on Good Friday, but for his entire life. But before we're too hard on Pilate, we need to remember that we too shall appear before Christ's judgment seat. We too will be held accountable for the decisions we make in our lives. And ultimately, there's one decision that's going to seal our fate. And it's actually in the form of a question we're going to look at in 2 weeks that Pilate asked at the end. What shall I do with Jesus? That's a question, that's a challenge put before every one of us. And we are given the authority to make a decision. What shall I do with Jesus? But we will be held accountable for the decision we make. And it will determine our eternal destiny.